Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This is for October 11th, 2018, and I apologize for missing last week. There were some events going on in my life, just really busy, overoccupied with some issues. All good, and back again for, I really don't like to miss this show. This is something that a lot of people depend on a weekly basis. And so anyway, I want to talk a little bit about the future of energy and water. These are very important topics, some issues that I've been dealing with over the past many years, but intensely over the past year. And so something that I felt very strongly about over 10 years ago, I positioned myself in front of what I understood was a real problem. The real problem was that as I did a study for the energy industry and also alternative energy industry, I realized that what was out there, basically solar panels and three-blade wind generators, that neither of those would solve our energy problem. In spite of the immense amount of investment and hype and attention given to those particular industries, those engineering developments. But also, my book, McCanny Wing Generator, World Energy Project, goes into a lot of detail about those studies. But what I want to talk about is the future. And the future that I see is very complicated because, for example, when we look at the world energy usage curve, what a lot of people don't understand, and say, for example, we talk about the United States and their reserves in the Gulf of Mexico, it could last another, say, 100 years. 100 years is not very much time. But there are countries in which the oil reserves are only a few years. Real situation for these foreign countries, and they do not have the wherewithal to purchase oil on the foreign market. They don't have the resources. They don't have the resources to convert what they're now taking out of the ground at their, you know, in their country. There are countries that are oil rich and exporting, and that's a problem too because they're exporting oil that eventually they're going to have to purchase in the future, some of them not many years off. This situation is causing some extreme border tension issues, and these are things that you really don't see. You don't hear about these in the news media. The U.S. news media is all wound up and with their underwear in knots over all kinds of issues that are, on the global scale, very petty issues. And they appear to be major issues, apparently, at the time. But when you think about foreign countries that potentially could be gearing up to go to war, creating or seemingly creating border tension, which is actually a result of resource or lack of resource management in these countries. This is a very scary situation because a lot of, let's say, political manipulation goes on in the background, but it comes down to energy. And we always think about the Middle East, you know, as a source of energy and global tension because of oil. And it's not too hard to predict if you understand economics at all. I mean, basic economics 101, that energy is the key to almost everything. It has been since man started using energy thousands of years ago when they first discovered petroleum in the Middle East. It was around 1200 AD. The future, the prediction that the future of the world depended on that area was not too difficult to see. But that's because the oil there was literally on the surface. It was pooled on the surface. And as soon as they expended the available resources on the surface of the earth, it didn't take them long to dig down into the sand and to find out that, wow, there's a lot more of this stuff down below the ground, or then locating it in the Caspian Sea, which was the cause of really the Afghan war. One of the causes was the United States trying to get a pipeline from the Caspian Sea down to the ocean where they could fill the tankers, because it's basically just sitting there free for the taking. It's being taken by Russia on the east. It's being taken by Eastern Europe on the west, and making those countries actually very vulnerable to invasion or control because of the, if you see like Ukraine or other areas that are where key locations for the movement of natural gas. Anyway, I could go on and on about the complications in the world dealing with energy. And water is the same. As time goes on, the world energy water situation becomes more dire in many situations. Now, just for example, drilling wells in many areas of the world, Matt Damon has had a program and supported various programs for drilling wells. But a lot of these dry up or become poisoned or basically or turn into salt wells. All kinds of situations occur. Not many parts of the world actually have good water from wells. They're not sustainable. Oh, they're only sustainable and they're very expensive. They're very difficult to maintain. The pumping of the water, etc. A lot of these wells become useless after as little as 1 year after being drilled. So the world is, in a sense, in a critical condition. I've talked about this before. The United States, the boom in using fracking to get cheap natural gas is going to come to an end in a couple years, 2 to 3, possibly at most 5 years, in the Dakotas, in areas like that where they're using fracking, explosive techniques or pressurized techniques underground to get more petroleum-based products, or natural gas, etc. And right now, the United States is exporting to China, which is becoming very dependent on the importation of natural gas from the United States. And it's cheap right now. But in 3 to 5 years, when the fracking has, the current level of fracking has expended the natural resources in those areas, all of a sudden, once again, you hit the energy crunch. Nuclear power plants in the United States are hitting the wall economically. They're all over age. They're at the end of their useful lifetime. There are no new nuclear power plants being built. And really, I've talked about this before, where the nuclear power plants, 110 or so in the United States, are leaking because of the pipes being old and corroded from the inside. And they really don't know how bad these situations are. Cleanup, there's just a whole plethora of issues related to nuclear power. The fact that there are slush funds that are required by federal agencies to reserve money for cleanup, but these are minimally funded and are not designed for the catastrophic level of cleanup that could occur with, say, any one given nuclear power plant. And the decommissioning of the plants, that money should have been set aside, but there's really no one who's going in and investigating whether that money has been set aside or not. So whenever there's a pool of money in the government, you might imagine that it's been borrowed or offset or with the best intentions, an IOU notice put in there to move the money to some other place to be replaced in some point in the future from unknown sources. So we see this all the time, like, say, with Social Security, how it was borrowed to pay, for example, for the Vietnam War. And so now Social Security is not being paid from funds, prior funds, but is simply being paid from new current employees that are paying into the system, and that money just gets transferred over to pay existing recipients of Social Security. So the question is, nobody, to my knowledge, is investigating or really doing an economic analysis of the slush funds that are being put aside, allegedly, to cover the decommissioning costs of nuclear power plants. But the reality is, the economic reality of nuclear power plants is they are at the wall. They are seeking funding, many of them trying to go to state governments or other federal governments agencies and saying, hey, look, we need a lot more money to keep these power plants open. And it's really a bad situation because they don't know what to do with the nuclear fuel. It's a horrendous situation, but just from an economic point of view, nuclear power plants are failing. And any power company that has a current holding in nuclear power plants is very much struggling. They're not paying for themselves. They're not economically viable against the current low cost of coal or the current lower cost of natural gas. And all of that is going to end in a couple of years. But the nuclear power plants are coming up to the end of their commissioned lifetimes. So nobody in the United States or in the entire world is really doing what I would call a good analysis of energy. It's something that I have done with my limited resources. If I were in charge of a government agency, I wouldn't be sitting there just managing year by year, giving out the permits and things like that. I would be doing a serious economic analysis of the energy industry in the United States because it's about to hit the brick wall. It already actually is hitting the brick wall. But if we could replace 60% to even 50% of that energy with renewable, and see, now that's where I was talking before about solar panels and three-blade wind generators, they, in spite of the serious amount of installations that have gone in, they really are not solving the problem. In fact, China, I've talked about this before in the show, recently China put a moratorium on solar panels. They did it in one day. Some of the biggest solar companies in the world who are dependent on future sales, upcoming contracts and future sales to China, including U.S. companies, European companies, that had massive sales for installation of solar panels in China. China just put a moratorium on them and said no more. China is not going to install more solar panels. And the reason is you cannot power down a nuclear power plant or a coal plant or a natural gas plant as they're using in China. You cannot simply power them down for 4 or 5 hours when the sun decides to shine. And then if all of a sudden the clouds come out, it does not give you reliable power. And the level of power that they use in China, there's no way you can store the energy in batteries. And that's always been the great downfall of solar. And in fact, three-blade wind generators, because they really don't produce their nameplate value of energy. And so the end result is that the vast investment, the United States probably has the biggest investment in three-blade wind generators in the world. At this point, there's probably close to over 90,000, probably pushing 100,000 that were installed using subsidies, government subsidies. But the subsidies have dried up, so the installations have dried up. The first thing that a company does if they're trying to put an installation is they go to the government. They don't go to a power company and say, hey, buy these three-blade wind generators. They'll make a profit for you because there's no payback. And when they run the numbers, there was another recent study done in Oklahoma. It was an area in Oklahoma that was going to service New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas with wind generation, with three-blade wind generators. And when the studies came out, they said this is not a viable economic investment because there's no payback. They don't generate enough electricity. So my predictions that I made 10 years ago, easily 10 years ago, are coming true. So the energy industry is in a tremendously serious, dire situation. The water situation, I mean, after the Flint, Michigan announcement came out that they had a problem with their water, more than a problem, and they talked only about lead. And one of the misstatements of the news media was where they simply talked about lead in the water in Flint, Michigan. But the pollution in the water of Flint, Michigan is so horrendous, lead is one of the least of their worries. And then they hand out these little faucet adapters that we figure probably work for lead only for maybe 40 gallons of water. And the people are putting those on their water, on their tap, on their kitchen faucet, thinking that somehow that is helping alleviate the problem. And it's not at all. Those are not filters that were designed for extensive use. They were meant primarily to remove sediment, and they'll remove a little bit of lead, etc. But they're, you know, people put these on and run them for months. They're simply not doing anything. So the end result, however, though, is that something like 20 cities came out after the Flint, Michigan issue, 20 cities in the United States saying that their water was worse than the water in Flint, Michigan. So the water situation is dire, but the water situation in the United States is better than the water situation in pretty much the rest of the world. Providing enough clean water, and then clean water for agriculture, which consumes a lot more, and say, for example, a cow drinking sometimes up to 30 gallons of water a day. That's one cow, a tremendous amount of water that they're consuming. So is the taxation on the resources, energy and water, and we're not, here's the big problem, we're not leaving anything for the future generations. And nobody is doing a real worldwide management analysis. This is something that should be done, and with real numbers, not fake numbers. But I think what you would find is that the world is in dire situation. And the studies that have been done really don't address these issues. And whether you're a proponent of global warming or not, a tremendous amount of money has been spent on studies for global warming that do not give solutions. They're simply studies to talk about what future climate changes may occur due to certain, you know, but they don't offer solutions. They don't offer data to really give us information on water pollution. There are some general studies which I've seen, but nothing detailed. Certainly nothing that gets down to the city or metropolitan area, even in the United States, let alone the rest of the world, which has a much more dire situation than the United States. So right now, the situation is that the future is not good, but it could change overnight with the use of, for example, the wind generator to offload it at current levels. If we could offload within a five-year period 50% of the energy that is produced through coal and nuclear and natural gas, that would be a big plus. And then start working into that second 50%. We're never going to shut down all of the nuclear power plants. And at this point, let me explain a type of generator that is already on the market. Now, if you go to certain islands around the world, either the Caribbean or the Pacific, etc., most of these places produce their electricity burning fuel oil. So that's the same as like diesel fuel, basically, number one or number two diesel fuel. And that's what they're burning to produce electricity. It's tremendously costly. And in terms of the islands that use this, they don't have no local natural resources. So that all of this is imported, and they have to pay for this. So their economy has this drain that's going away. But guess what? All of these locations have wind. They typically also have solar. But for large scale, so people put solar panels on their house. But for a large scale, for community use, solar has not proven to be a viable source of energy simply because of the storage aspect. And so if you burn a certain amount of electricity in a day and you only have 4 or 5 hours, truly good hours of sun per day, the industry average uses the number four solar hours per day. And that's because the sun is not hitting the solar panels directly. That includes cloud time, because in the tropics, you think, oh, there's a lot of sun. But by 11 in the morning, the clouds are there blocking the sun. And that's very typical in the tropical setting. So it's not like, say, Phoenix, where you have desert dry air and a lot of sun. Most islands, by, like I say, even 10 o'clock in the morning, are already clouding up and blocking the sun. So solar is not a solution. And plus the expense of buying the batteries to store the energy for the rest of the day and night simply is an economic impossibility. And so a long time ago, I discovered and wrote that in my book and made it very clear that wind is the only viable alternative energy solution. And so, by the way, I've started talking about the wind generator being the alternative to alternative energy. And there's no choice. There's no choice at this point. The world has to find an alternative to burning coal, nuclear, and natural gas in the power plants. It has to. And we can no longer sit and look at a graph, which I've looked at myself, and it looks convincing that in the world, sometime towards the end of this century, we will actually run out of coal and nuclear and natural gas resources. The big three are going to go away at some point. So are we going to just burn it until it all ends? But the real issue is there are countries that are already running out. There are countries that are exporting that should not be exporting because they're doing that for current immediate profits. But, you know, then they're going to have to buy it back from somebody else in the future and not that far into the future. These countries simply are going to fold financially, and without energy, they're just going to really go back to the cave ages. So something serious has to be done. And the situation with water is similar. I mean, we're just on a crash course. So that's why I'm spending my time, and that's why I missed this, getting back to the topic, that's why I missed the show last week, because I am putting a tremendous amount of my time into trying to solve these problems and push this, what I call my World Energy Water Project, to push this forward and get it up to the point where it's really having results in the world, that it's actually making a difference. So I'm going to turn my conversation here to Comet K2, that I've been talking about in the last couple of weeks, but there's no way that we can continue. And, you know, a lot of people with money are, this is one of the unfortunate things, a lot of people with money are investing in energy. And that would be the big three, oil, coal, and natural gas. because currently that's where the profit is. That's where people are making money. And investors, obviously, that's where they're going to put their money, is where they're going to get a return on investment. But it's a situation that current profits have to be balanced with future, because they're not going to continue making profits forever. But I know a lot of people who are investors, and in spite of things that are known like that, they continue to invest in the Standard Energy Industries, because that literally is where the bigger profits are today. Okay, just a quick notice. Today earlier, an accident in Russia that occurred when an American and a Russian cosmonaut, an American astronaut, were going to the International Space Station, and the very reliable Russian launch system, there was a failure in the rocket. So they had an emergency bailout, had to return by parachute the space capsule that they have an escape system. And so they made an emergency landing, and a little bit shaken up, but in good condition. Apparently the Russian cosmonaut had a few more injuries, because apparently there was not enough room for the parachutes to actually completely activate and slow this spacecraft down. So at any rate, everybody is alive, everybody is well, but there was an unknown cause. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this also is that the Russian launch system over the decades has been extremely reliable. So this is a very unusual situation. But also recently, interestingly enough, there was an incident on the International Space Station where there was a leak, not an information leak, but a pressure leak. And so there was speculation that this was somehow not caused by an accident. In other words, that some person caused this pressure leak in the International Space Station. And there was a bit of an international row, and they're actually investigating it to see what happened. But that's something that I'll see if we ever get a resolution on that, if we ever find an actual answer to what happened there. But just the fact that there was speculation on that issue raises some interesting questions. But the agencies promised that they would be working in the future, but apparently there's some kind of tension going on in the background. Now, so that's interesting. I think that's the bigger story. What is this invisible tension between the United States and Russia regarding the International Space Station? So I don't want to make any speculations, because that could be all over the board as to what that may be about, if it even exists. So just an interesting point. Also, there's no follow-up from the National Solar Observatory that was closed a number of weeks ago. Remember that, when the FBI walked into the National Solar Observatory in New Mexico and just made everybody just stand up and walk out. And the excuse, of course, that they used did not hold water. So there's been no further information coming from that. So I have no idea. It's something that is so vague, and I believe the only reason we knew about it is because somebody did a tweet on the way out the door, and that's the way the public actually found out about this. If it were not for that, social media, we probably would not even know that that occurred. Anyway, I don't have any answers. I really don't have any speculation. There's been a lot of speculation, but that's all it is. It's speculation, and all we know is that the official reason for closing down that facility didn't add up. And the local sheriff, in fact, was looking for information, and I actually doubt if he got any real information, and he's the local legal authority in the area. Okay, well, enough of that. back to discussing Comet K2. Now, in previous weeks, I've been talking about orbital dynamics. In other words, what happens if you have an object that's, say, an asteroid, comet, nucleus, whatever, and you give it a nudge, and what happens, you know, many years later? That little nudge is at in the distance past is equivalent to a big nudge many years later. So let's say that we're able to calculate that a given object in 3 years, say, is going to have a close encounter with Earth. Its orbit will be somewhat in the vicinity of Earth. And you say, well, if we just give it a little push, it'll, you know, years earlier, it'll put it way out of range of Earth. And so that's a viable option. But then I explained also that what if your calculations are wrong? What if that object gets hit by another object in the interim and you're not aware of it, changing what you did again? Or what if your data is incorrect and off by just a little bit, the velocity, the position, vector, etc. of this object? And what if you're off by 0.001%? And, you know, those are the kind of values that could affect where this thing ends up relative to where your prediction is. So computer rounding errors, all of these different factors enter into trying to make a prediction far in the future as to whether something, in fact, will have an effect, come close to Earth or actually hit the Earth. And, of course, hitting the Earth is most of the concern of professional scientists. And what I've said in the past is if the object is large enough, then you don't have to hit Earth. Just coming close by would be sufficient to cause damage. And this could be electrical, magnetic, or, in fact, gravitational if they're large enough. So, coming back to the issue of Comet K2, I've also talked about the orbit analysis and the various dates when it will cross the ecliptic plane, and these are dates that are based on its current orbit. But since it's already developed a tail, the tail drag is going to have an effect, and so it'll be interesting to see if the ephemeris, the calendar, the projected orbit of this object remains the same throughout the future. And that is the question. Let me just compare this a little bit with Comet Hale-Bopp, which came in from the southern region of the solar system. And I remember I'm the first one that brought up the issue of something coming from the south. And that was an interesting, fun fact, that Comet Hale-Bopp was coming from that southern region of the solar system because that is where the NASA-funded Naval Observatory study was looking for what they called Planet X. And that was literally the beginning of the Planet X topic as such. The Sitchin story, which had the inaccurate orbit that came from Harrington himself, the head of the Naval Observatory, and that's where that's continually incorrect concept of 3,600 years came from. And so anyway, I don't want to get into all of that because it's such a distorted piece of history. But it's interesting to note that Hale-Bopp, being the largest comet in at least recent history, coming from that southern region of the solar system. So there was so much, my point is that there was so much concentration on that southern region of the solar system because of the intense search that was actually taking place because the planets Uranus and Neptune being pulled down in their orbits. But this Comet K2 is interesting because it's coming from, in a sense, the complete opposite side of the solar system. It's coming in from the north. And that's something that I've said all along, is that these things can come in from any direction. There's not some magical direction that all large comets have to come from. This comet is coming in from the north. And the next one could be from a totally different direction, we don't know. We don't have a history. We even if you look back and say history books, etc., that do refer to comets, we don't have a real history because, say, a comet that came through the solar system 10,000 years ago that has a 100,000-year orbit. I mean, we have literally no history for this. We have no inkling of this. There's no human recordings that go back that far, and certainly none that would give us any real information about where they're coming from or where they're going or how long they've spent in the solar system. Certainly nothing. The only real piece of information that we have is the Indian rock petroglyph that I have on the cover of my first book. But coming in from the north is a very good indication that these things, as I say, come in from any and all directions. But is once again, I want to talk about the probability that this comet K2, number one, is it large? Yes, it's very large. Do they have an inkling of how large it is at this point? Well, probably, because you can use radio waves coming from radio telescope facilities to bounce signals off the comet nucleus and get an idea of its size. What they do, however, use is what we call albedo measurements. In other words, when this, they would go back into star charts before this object erupted into a comet, they would take albedo measurements, and assuming that this should be a white object, taking that albedo measurement would make it a very small object. In other words, a small alleged white object would reflect a lot more light than a large black object. And so they're still making this assumption that this nucleus should be white, although we've never ever seen a white comet nucleus. They've all been black, pure black. And so the end result is that if you use an albedo measurement, in other words, a light intensity measurement from the comet nucleus prior to it becoming a comet, forming a coma and a tail, then the end result is that the nucleus has to be much bigger. And in fact, it could be thousands or even tens of thousands of times larger, because what you do is you take a light reading. Okay, that's the amount of light. If you assume that that nucleus is white, then it does not take much of a nuclear cross-section, nucleus of the comet. It does not take much of a cross-section that's white to give you that amount of reflected light. But if the object is black, which we know it is because nobody's ever seen a white comet nucleus or anything even close to it, so now you need a much larger black surface to reflect the same amount of light to get the light intensity measurement. So the end result is that the estimated size that they're trying to give you, something like 15 miles across, is one I heard recently, is based on light data, which is patently incorrect. It could not possibly be true. So if it was 15 miles across, 1,000 times that surface area would make it probably about not 1,000 times larger, but 1,000 times the surface area, take the square root of that, and that could be like 30 times larger or 40 times larger in the radial direction. In other words, you take the square root, if it's 1,000th the albedo, the light reflectivity of the object, then you take the square root of that because you're looking at a surface area. And so that could give you an object that's 30 times, let's say, on average, larger than what they're estimating. So very interesting that the nucleus, instead of being 15 miles across, it would be possibly 500 miles across, or it could be larger if the difference in albedo, that there, because they're not telling us their assumed albedo or reflectivity of this object, it could be 1,000 times, could be 10,000 times different. And so anyway, the bottom line is we do not have any kind of real data, significant data, on the size of the nucleus of K2, and we're not going to have that. We could have had with Hale-Bopp because it did have a companion when it was originally, I mean, the NASA photos clearly showed the companion, and the companion was discussed at the Canary Islands conference post-Hale-Bopp. It was discussed by all of the scientists there as being a reality. And so using the orbital period of the companion and the distance to the nucleus gives you a calculation that allows you to determine the mass. But Comet K2 does not, from all we understand, does not have a companion. At least it has not become visible yet. And that companion would, if it existed, if there were one, it would allow us to make a measurement, a calculation of the mass of the nucleus. So we don't have that particular tool to use to estimate the size of the nucleus of Comet K2. All we have are albedo measurements, and they're not letting out the radio telescope data, which I guarantee you does exist. Okay, so that's one major point, is the question, how large is the nucleus of K2? And so without any real data, I can't make a projection, but I can guarantee you it's not 15 miles across. So also discharging the solar capacitor up in that region is not... it's not what we would call a fertile area for tail material. And so that's a very interesting point, too, is that this comet formed in a very northern part of the solar system where we don't have the nebular ion cloud that would be a good source of tail material for the comet. So anyway, these are interesting, somewhat unusual facts about this comet, that we don't have a lot of information. It's a very unusual comet. It was discovered at an extreme distance from the sun, the most distant comet ever discovered to date from the sun. It's already very large, and we don't have data on other comets that have come in from this region. So a lot of unknowns here. Okay, now I'm going to talk about some parts of comets that I have not mentioned before in previous weeks at all, and that is the potential for observation from Earth, us Earthlings, watching Comet K2, and the potential for a sunward spike. Now, there again, if you look at the cover of my book, my first book, The Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes book, the cover photo has the squiggly line, or the what in three dimensions would be a spiral, or like a corkscrew, basically, of an electrical discharge characteristic of a discharge in a magnetic field, and drawn twice, so that's very characteristic. But the question is, with a comet of the size of K2, would we finally become... come into a position where we could see an electrical discharge of this type? There are also types of discharges that are referred to in the ancient texts, and these are called the horns of the beast, and it's a proton effect coming out the sides, basically the sides of the comet nucleus in the sunward direction, and it gives it the appearance of like horns of a bull. And so if you have a comet, then these horn-like shapes, it's very characteristic. In fact, we've seen this with moons, not actually with visible light, but we've seen this in the infrared and also ultraviolet light with moons around other planets, specifically Saturn. So this is something that the moon Dion of Saturn is an example of the effect of horns of the bull, or Io of Jupiter is another moon which has this same electrical discharge effect. because you can see the auroral spots at the north and south pole of Jupiter following Io as it goes around in its orbit. And that's from these horn-like shaped discharges between Io and the planet. The same with the moon of Saturn, the same situation. Okay, so the interesting thing that we might pull out of this, aside from learning about tail drag, because as this comet comes in from the north, something very different than Comet Hale-Bopp, the orbit of Hale-Bopp was changed on a daily basis. Eventually, astronomers attributed that to an interaction gravitationally with the planet Jupiter. And we were able to watch the ephemeris, the predicted orbital path of Hale-Bopp, change on a daily basis. And so astronomers had this kind of ace in the hole that they used excuse that Hale-Bopp's orbit was changed with an interaction with Jupiter. But the interesting thing about K2 is it does not have any interaction with Jupiter on the inbound path. So if its orbit is changed drastically, there's only one thing that can do it. It's tail drag, and it's not due to some kind of interaction gravitationally with Jupiter. So this is very interesting. That's something we'll be watching, and I've been keeping track of the estimated orbits based on the data, and we're going to see if these change on a regular basis, as did Comet Hale-Bopp. So all of this very interesting. This comet is very unique, but we should be in a position during the, many, many months, actually years, that this comet is going to be visible. Now, this could break Hale-Bopp's record. Hale-Bopp was visible to the naked eye for a period of 6 years. That's phenomenal because most comets are visible for a day, a two, to the naked eye, if they're even at all visible to the naked eye. They're only visible for, a few days, or even with telescopes, only visible for a short period of time, maybe a week or two, and then they're gone. But Hale-Bopp was visible to the naked eye for a period of 6 years, which broke, it just shattered completely all previous records regarding comets. And so this comet K2 now has potential to shatter Hale-Bopp's record of longevity, visibility to the naked eye. It's a bit farther out. It's in a bit different region of the solar system, and it has to compete with the position that it's in relative to the sun, also the full moon or the moon in the night sky, all of these other factors which prevent you seeing a faint object. So the current prediction is that it's not going to be very visible, just at the very edge of visibility with the naked eye, because it's very far away. It's going to be outside the orbit of Mars, and then it drops down into the lower part of the solar system, then comes back up, actually out beyond Jupiter. And so it's going to be something that will be relatively difficult to see. But amateurs with telescopes will be able to look and see if it has any electrical interactions. Recall I talked about it having interactions potentially with Jupiter on its outbound path. So that's something that's coming in the first encounter. I gave these dates in 2022. So this is actually many years out. So this will give amateurs a good chance to track this comet for, look at all of the years. We're now in 2018. It will be 2022. It'll be another 4 years that amateurs will be able to track this object, study it, and then once it gets close enough down to the ecliptic plane where they can actually start potentially seeing sunward spikes at an angle. Now, this is important because I've had sunward spike studies before where I've tried to employ amateur astronomers, but what's important is to have a broadside view. And the reason that's important, because the official astronomical explanation for sunward spikes is that it is an optical illusion of an anti-sunward tail. And so anyway, that really, in many cases, does not hold water. But it's going to be interesting to see if Comet K2, including orbital changes, will be in a position where from Earth we'll be able to see sunward spikes from the broadside, from the side of the comet, to in fact assure you that it's a sunward spike, that the electrical connection that is visible is to the sunward side. And the reason it's visible, because that electronic beam, the beam of electrons coming in from the sunward side, is interacting with plasma material, and so that's what creates the visible sunward spike, although it's there all the time. Astronomers can take X-ray telescopes, look at a comet, and they always see X-rays up on that sunward side. And a recent study, as I announced on this show a while ago, is that they are now proven to be Bremsstrahlung X-rays, which are a German word for breaking X-rays. In other words, that's the type of X-ray that's created in a dental machine. When you go to the dentist and they take an X-ray of your jaw, your teeth, those are Bremsstrahlung X-rays. And it gives you a very unique spectrum of X-rays, and it's caused because the electrons break. This Bremsstrahlung is a German word for breaking, so they're breaking X-rays caused by the electrons slowing down, and the slowing down, that change in the electromagnetic field around the electron causes an X-ray. And so the X-ray is generated because the electron sees either an electric field or typically an electric field that causes it to slow down, generating an X-ray. So it's been confirmed that comets, in fact, the X-rays to the sunward side are Bremsstrahlung X-rays, is what I've been saying all along. It's what I said when they were first discovered, that those are Bremsstrahlung. And they said, no, those are not Bremsstrahlung. Those have a spectrum. And now it's known very well that, in fact, they are Bremsstrahlung X-rays on the nose side of the comet. But at any rate, that's because they're interacting with the local plasma and the charge in the comet nucleus. So that's the cause of the Bremsstrahlung X-rays. But also those will be visible if the astronomers do publish the information on X-rays. That's something that the typical amateur does not have access to. But the amateurs do have access to the visible part of the spectrum, and that's where they can take photographic plates or photographic ICD, images, electronic images, and the amateurs have very good equipment these days to show that, in fact, the sunward spike is sunward and not an anti-sunward direction. So this is something that we'll be dealing more with as this comet approaches. Okay, so that's the lesson of the day for Comet K2. So those are some interesting things that I'll be talking about more in the future. And I'll probably divert from this topic next week because we've got years to go yet until this comet gets here. But it's such an interesting comet. It's the biggest comet. It's the most distant comet ever discovered in the history of planet Earth. And so I think we have some interesting observations in store for us here. Okay, the last few minutes, I just want to talk about the water filters. They're still on sale on my webpage, and just remind you that that is my source of funding to maintain this program, to maintain the webpage. And by the way, the webpage is just about ready to go live. We're doing some final touch-up, there's a lot of content there. So it's took a great deal of work to get that web page transferred over to a new format and have it modernized with the SSL certificate security, socket security layer, which is when you go to a website and there's the little lock up on the left-hand corner and it shows it's a secure site. All of that information, those certificates, and that's showing that it's a secure website, and the you can visit it without any problems, etc. Even though I've never really had any problem with my web page and the old web page, but it's been a real challenge to put all of this into a new format. Also, much easier to locate. I've been criticized in the past for having a web page that's very difficult to navigate. This will be much easier to navigate, and with outlines, with new information that's clickable, so you don't have to read everything on the homepage. There will be clickable items that you can go off and then easily get back to the homepage, or go to other subpages from any place in the structure. So all of this taking place, but once again, the money to keep all of this moving comes, the only place it comes from is from the sale of my water filter products, which are the best water filter products on the planet. You do not have to add-on filters to take out fluoride and arsenic, something that almost everybody has in their water. And especially places like, say, Flint, Michigan, or other places around the country, my filters take out more sediment and chemicals, etc., than any other filter, with not requiring add-on filters. My filters cost less than the add-on filters of other brands, if you can imagine that. So go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. And support that. All my books are there, and also the paid cast. And the paid cast, I have gotten behind a little bit because in recent weeks I have been 100%, not even 100, I've been about 180% working on some projects that are just, I'm very pleased with the results, but it all takes time. So the paid cast, that's something I'll be working on here over the next weekend, getting those back up to date, just so people understand what's going on. And it's not because I'm lazy. It's because I'm just overpowered with the amount of work that I've been doing. So once again, this show I thought was very important because of the energy water issues that the world is facing, something that I'm working on. And it's just so important. I can't stress it enough. And I believe all of my work is going to benefit many people. So worth the time, worth the effort. So once again, go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. Purchase the water filters, the commercial water filters on sale also. Very good prices. And if you purchase the replacement filters with the commercial filters, you get a very good deal on those. When you originally purchase the commercial filter for your house, well, you call them whole house filters, you also get a very good deal on the filter elements. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.